sorry. Couldn't resist. I'm not joking, Emma said, and she took her hands out from behind her back. They were glowing red, and even from 3 feet away I could feel the heat they gave off. The soldier jumped out of her reach.
Hot touch and a temper to match, he said. I like that in a woman. But burn me, and Clark there'll spackle the wall with your brainy bits.
The soldier he'd indicated pressed the barrel of his rifle to Emma's head. Emma squeezed her eyes shut, her chest rising and falling fast. Then she lowered her hands and folded them behind her back. She was positively vibrating with anger. So was I.
Careful now, the soldier warned her. No sudden moves.
My fists clenched as I watched him slide his hands up and down her legs, then run his fingers under the neckline of her dress, all with unnecessary slowness and a leering grin. I'd never felt so powerless in all my life, not even when we were trapped in that animal cage.
She doesn't have anything, I shouted. Leave her alone!
I was ignored.
I like this one, the soldier said to Mr. White. I think we should keep her a while. For science.
Mr. White grimaced.
You are a disgusting specimen, Corporal. But I agree with you. She is fascinating. I've heard about you, you know, he said to Emma. I'd give anything to do what you can do. If only we could bottle those hands of yours.
Mr. White smiled weirdly before turning back to the soldier.
Finish up, he snapped. We don't have all day. With pleasure, the soldier replied, and then he stood, dragging his hands up Emma's torso as he rose.
What happened next seemed to unfold in slow motion. I could see that this disgusting lech was about to lean in and give Emma a kiss. I could also see that, behind her back, Emma's hands were now lined with flame. I knew where this was going. The second his lips got near her, she was going to reach around and melt his face, even if it meant taking a bullet. She'd reached a breaking point. So had I. I tensed, ready to fight. These, I was convinced, were our last moments. But we'd live them on our own terms. And if we were going to die, by God, we'd take a few whites with us along the way. The soldier slid his hands around Emma's waist. The barrel of another's rifle dug into her forehead. She seemed to be pushing back against it, daring it to fire. Behind her back I saw her hands begin to spread, white-hot flame tracing along each of her fingers.
Here we go.
Then, crack! The report of a gun, stunning and sharp. I shut down, blacked out for a second. When my sight came back, Emma was still standing, her head still intact. The rifle that had been pressed against it was pointed down now, and the soldier who'd been about to kiss her had pulled away and spun around to face the window. The gunshot had come from outside. Every nerve in my body had gone numb, tingling with adrenaline.
"What was that?"
said Mr. White, rushing to the window. I could see through the glass over his shoulder. The soldier who'd gone to intercept the train was standing outside, waist deep in wildflowers. His back was to us, his rifle aimed at the field. Mr. White reached through the bars that covered the window and pushed it open.
"What the hell are you shooting at?" he shouted. "Why are you still here?"
The soldier didn't move, didn't speak. The field was alive with the whine of insects, and briefly, that's all we could hear.
"Corporal Brown!"
bellowed Mr. White. The man turned slowly, unsteady on his feet. The rifle slipped from his hands and fell into the tall grass. He took a few doddering steps forward. Mr. White took the revolver from his holster and pointed it out the window at Brown.
"Say something, damn you!"
Brown opened his mouth and tried to speak, but where his voice should have been, an eerie droning noise came echoing up from his guts, mimicking the sound that was everywhere in the fields around him. It was the sound of bees. Hundreds, thousands of them. Next came the bees themselves, just a few at first, drifting through his parted lips. Then some power beyond his own seemed to take hold of him. His shoulders pulled back, and his chest pressed forward, and his jaws ratcheted wide open, and from his gaping mouth there poured forth such a dense stream of bees that they were like one solid object, a long, fat hose of insects unspooling endlessly from his throat. Mr. White stumbled back from the window, horrified and baffled. Out in the field, Brown collapsed in a cloud of stinging insects. As his body fell, another was revealed behind him. It was a boy. Hugh. He stood defiantly, staring through the window. The insects swung around him in a great whirling sphere. The fields were packed with them, honeybees and hornets, wasps and yellowjackets, stinging things I couldn't know or name, and every last one of them seemed to be at his command. Mr. White raised his gun and fired, emptied his clip. Hugh went down, disappearing in the grass. I didn't know whether he had fallen to the ground or dived to it. Then three other soldiers ran to the window, and while Bronwyn cried, "Please don't kill him!" they raked the field with bullets, filling our ears with the thunder of their guns. Then there were bees in the room, a dozen, maybe, furious and flinging themselves at the soldiers.
"Shut the window!"
Mr. White screamed, swatting the air around him. A soldier slammed the window closed. They all went to work smacking the bees that had gotten in. While they were busy with that, more and more collected outside, a giant seething blanket of them pulsing against the other side of the glass, so many that by the time Mr. White and his men had finished killing the bees inside the room, the ones outside had nearly shut out the sun. The soldiers clustered in the middle of the floor, backs together, rifles bristling out like porcupine quills. It was dark and hot, and the alien whine of a million manic bees reverberated through the room like something out of a nightmare.
"Make them leave us alone!"
Mr. White shouted, his voice cracking, desperate. As if anyone but Hugh could do that, if he was still alive.
"I'll make you another offer," said Bakir,
pulling himself to his feet using the window bars, his hobbled silhouette outlined against the dark glass.
"Put down your guns, or I open this window."
Mr. White spun to face him.
"Even a gypsy wouldn't be stupid enough to do that."
"You think too highly of us," Bakir said,
sliding his fingers toward the handle. The soldiers raised their rifles.
"Go ahead," said Bakir. "Shoot."
"Don't! You'll break the glass!"
Mr. White shouted.
"Grab him!"
Two soldiers threw down their rifles and lunged at Bakir, but not before he punched his fist through the glass. The entire window shattered. Bees flushed into the room. Chaos erupted, screams, gunfire, shoving, though I could hardly hear it over the roar of the insects, which seemed to fill not just my ears, but every pore of my body. People were climbing over one another to get out. To my right, I saw Bronwyn push Olive to the floor and cover her with her body. Emma shouted, "Get down!" and we ducked for cover as bees tumbled over our skin, our hair. I waited to die, for the bees to cover every exposed inch of me in stings that would shut down my nervous system. Someone kicked open the door. Light blasted in. A dozen boots thundered across the floorboards. It got quiet. I slowly uncovered my head. The bees were gone. So were the soldiers. Then, from outside, a chorus of panicked screams. I jumped up and rushed to the shattered window, where a knot of gypsies and peculiars were already gathered, peering out. At first, I didn't see the soldiers at all, just a giant, swirling mass of insects, so dense it was opaque, about 50 feet down the footpath. The screams were coming from inside it. Then, one by one, the screamers fell silent. When it was all over, the cloud of bees began to spread and scatter, unveiling the bodies of Mr. White and his men. They lay clustered in the low grass, dead or nearly so. 20 seconds later, their killers were gone, their monstrous hum fading as they settled back into the fields. In their wake fell a strange and bucolic calm, as if it were just another summer day, and nothing out of the ordinary had happened. Emma counted the soldiers' bodies on her fingers.
6. That's all of them, she said. It's over.
I put my arms around her, shaking with gratitude and disbelief.
Which of you are hurt?
Said Bronwyn, looking around frantically. Those last moments had been crazy. Countless bees, gunfire in the dark. We checked ourselves for holes. Horace was dazed but conscious, a trickle of blood running from his temple. Bakir's stab wound was deep but would heal. The rest of us were shaken but unhurt, and miraculously, not a single one of us was bee-stung. "When you broke the window," I said to Bakir, "how did you know the bees wouldn't attack us?"
"I didn't," he said. "Luckily, your friend's power is strong."
Our friend. Emma pulled away from me suddenly.
"Oh my God!" she gasped. "Phew!"
In all the chaos, we'd forgotten about him. He was probably bleeding to death right now, somewhere in the tall grass. But just as we were about to tear outside and look for him, he appeared in the doorway, bedraggled and grass-stained, but smiling.
"Phew!"
Olive cried, rushing to him.
"You're alive!"
"I am," he said heartily. "Are all of you?"
"Thanks to you, we are," Bronwyn said.
3 cheers for Hugh!"
"You're our man in a pinch, Hugh," cried Horace.
"Nowhere am I deadlier than in a field of wildflowers,"
Hugh said, enjoying the attention.
"Sorry about all the times I made fun of your peculiarity," said Enoch. "I suppose it's not so useless."
"Additionally," said Millard, "I'd like to compliment Hugh on his impeccable timing. Really, if you'd arrived just a few seconds later..."
Hugh explained how he'd evaded capture at the depot by slipping down between the train and the platform, just like I'd thought. He'd sent one of his bees trailing after us, which allowed him to follow from a careful distance.
"Then it was just a matter of finding the perfect time to strike," he said proudly, as if victory had been assured from the moment he decided to save us.
"And if you hadn't accidentally stumbled across a field packed with bees," Enoch said.
Hugh dug something from his pocket and held it up, a peculiar chicken egg.
"Plan B," he said.
Bakir hobbled to Hugh and shook his hand.
"Young man," he said, "we owe you our lives."
"What about your peculiar boy?" Millard asked Bakir.
"He managed to escape with 2 of my men, thank God. We lost 3 fine animals today, but no people."
Bakir bowed to Hugh, and I thought for a moment he might even take Hugh's hand and kiss it.
"You must allow us to repay you."
Hugh blushed.
"There's no need, I assure you." "And no time either," said Emma, pushing Hugh out the door. "We have a train to catch!"
Those of us who hadn't yet realized Miss Peregrine was gone went pale.
"We'll take their jeep," said Millard. "If we're lucky, and if that wait was correct, we might just be able to catch the train during its stopover in Porthmadog."
"I know a shortcut," the Kier said, and he drew a simple map in the dirt with his shoe.
We thanked the gypsies. I told Bakir we were sorry we'd caused them so much trouble, and he unleashed a big, booming laugh and waved us on down the path.
"We'll meet again, Sindragasti," he said. "I'm certain of it."
We squeezed into the White's jeep, eight kids packed like sardines into a vehicle built for three. Because I was the only one who'd driven a car before, I took the wheel. I spent way too long figuring out how to start the damn thing, not with a key, it turned out, but by pushing a button on the floor. And then there was the matter of shifting gears. I'd only driven a manual transmission a few times, and always with my dad coaching me from the passenger seat. Despite all that, after a minute or two, we were, bumpily, jerkily, somewhat hesitatingly, on our way. I stomped the accelerator and drove as fast as the overloaded jeep would take us, while Millard shouted directions and everyone else held on for dear life. We reached the town of Porthmadog 20 minutes later, the train's whistle blowing as we sped down the main street toward the station. We came to a skidding stop by the depot and tumbled out. I didn't even bother to kill the engine. Racing through the station like cheetahs after a gazelle, we leapt on board the last car of the train just as it was pulling out of the station. We stood, doubled over and panting in the aisle, while astonished passengers pretended not to stare. Sweating, dirty, and disheveled, we must have been a sight.
"We made it," Emma gasped. "I can't believe we made it." "I can't believe I drove sick," I said.
The conductor appeared.
"You're back," he said with a beleaguered sigh. "I trust you still have your tickets."
Horace fished them from his pocket in a wad.
"This way to your cabin," said the conductor.
"Our trunk,"
Bronwyn said, clutching at the conductor's elbow.
"Is it still there?"
The conductor pried his arm away.
"I tried taking it to Lost and Found. Couldn't move the blessed thing an inch."
We ran from car to car until we reached the first-class cabin, where we found Bronwyn's trunk sitting just where she'd left it. She rushed to it and threw open the latches, then the lid. Miss Peregrine wasn't inside. I had a mini heart attack.
"My bird!" Bronwyn cried. "Where's my bird?"
"Calm down, it's right here," said the conductor,
and he pointed above our heads. Miss Peregrine was perched on a luggage rack, fast asleep. Bronwyn stumbled back against the wall, so relieved she nearly fainted.
"How did she get up there?"
The conductor raised an eyebrow.
"It's a very lifelike toy."
He turned and went to the door, then stopped and said, "By the way, where can I get one? My daughter would just love it."
"I'm afraid she's one of a kind," Bronwyn said,
and she took Miss Peregrine down and hugged her to her chest. After all we'd been through over the past few days, not to mention the past few hours, the luxury of the first-class cabin came as a shock. Our car had plush leather couches, a dining table, and wide picture windows. It looked like a rich man's living room, and we had it all to ourselves. We took turns washing up in the wood-paneled bathroom, then availed ourselves of the dining menu.
"Order anything you like,"
Enoch said, picking up a telephone that was attached to the arm of a reclining chair.
"Hello, do you have goose liver pate? I should like all of it." "Yes, all that you have. And toast triangles."
No one said anything about what had happened. It was too much, too awful. And for now, we just wanted to recover and forget. There was so much else to be done, so many more dangers left to reckon with. We settled in for the journey. Outside, Porthmadog's squat houses shrank away, and Miss Wren's mountain came into view, rising grayly above the hills. While the others drifted into conversations, my nose stayed glued to the window, and the endless unfolding there-ness of 1940 beyond it. 1940 being a place that had until recently been merely pocket-sized in my experience, no wider than a tiny island, and a place I could leave any time I wished by passing through the dark belly of Cairnholm's cairn. Since leaving the island, though, it had become a world, a whole world of marshy forests and smoke-wreathed towns and valleys crisscrossed with shining rivers, and of people and things that looked old but weren't yet, like props and extras in some elaborately staged but plotless period movie, all of it flashing by and by and by out my window like a dream without end. I fell asleep and woke, fell asleep and woke, the train's rhythm hypnotizing me into a hazy state in which it was easy to forget that I was more than just a passive viewer, my window more than just a movie screen, that out there was every bit as real as in here. Then, slowly, I remembered how I'd come to be part of this. My grandfather. The island. The children. The pretty, flint-eyed girl next to me, her hand resting atop mine. "Am I really here?" I asked her.
"Go back to sleep," she said.
"Do you think we'll be all right?" She kissed me on the tip of my nose.
"Go back to sleep."
Chapter 7. More terrible dreams, all mixed up, fading in and out of one another. Snippets of horrors from recent days, the steel eye of a gun barrel staring me down from close range, a road strewn with fallen horses, a hologast's tongue straining toward me across a chasm, that awful grinning white and his empty eyes. Then this. I'm back home again, but I'm a ghost. I drift down my street, through my front door, into my house. I find my father asleep at the kitchen table, a cordless phone clutched to his chest. "I'm not dead," I say. But my words don't make sound. I find my mother sitting on the edge of her bed, still in night clothes, staring out the window at a pale afternoon. She's gaunt, wrung out from crying. I reach out to touch her shoulder, but my hand passes right through it. Then I'm at my own funeral, looking up from my grave at a rectangle of gray sky. My three uncles peer down, their fat necks bulging from starched white collars. Uncle Les, "What a pity, right?" Uncle Jack, "You really got a feel for Frank and Marianne right now." Uncle Les, "Yeah, what are people gonna think?" Uncle Bobby, "They'll think the kid had a screw loose, which he did." Uncle Jack, "I knew it, though, that he'd pull something like this one day. He had that look, you know? Just a little..." Uncle Bobby, "Screwy." Uncle Les, "That comes from his dad's side of the family, not ours." Uncle Jack, "Still, terrible." Uncle Bobby, "Yeah." Uncle Jack, Uncle Les, Uncle Bobby, "Buffet?" My uncles shuffle away. Ricky comes along, his green hair extra spiked for the occasion. "Bro, now that you're dead, can I have your bike?" I try to shout, "I'm not dead! I am just far away! I'm sorry!" But the words echo back at me, trapped inside my head. The minister peers down. It's Golan, holding a Bible, dressed in robes. He grins.
We're waiting for you, Jacob.
A shovel full of dirt rains down on me.
We're waiting.
I bolted upright, suddenly awake, my mouth dry as paper. Emma was next to me, hands on my shoulders.
Jacob! Thank God you gave us a scare.
I did.
You're having a nightmare, said Millard. He was seated across from us, looking like an empty suit of clothes starched into position.
Talking in your sleep, too.
I was.
Emma dabbed sweat from my forehead with one of the first-class napkins, real cloth.
You were, she said, but it sounded like gobbledygook. I couldn't understand a word.
I looked around self-consciously, but no one else seemed to have noticed. The other children were spread throughout the car, catnapping, daydreaming out the window, or playing cards. I sincerely hoped I was not starting to lose it.
Do you often have nightmares? Asked Millard.
You should describe them to Horace. He's good at sussing hidden meanings from dreams.
Emma rubbed my arm.
You sure you're all right?
I'm fine, I said. And because I don't like being fussed over, I changed the subject. Seeing that Millard had the Tales of the Peculiar open in his lap, I said, "Doing some light reading?"
"Studying," he replied. "And to think I once dismissed these as just stories for children. They are, in fact, extraordinarily complex, cunning even, in the way they conceal secret information about peculiardom. It would take me years, probably, to decode them all."
"But what good is that to us now?" Emma said. "What good are loops if they can be breached by Hologast? Even the secret ones in that book will be found out eventually."
"Maybe it was just the one loop that was breached," I said hopefully. "Maybe the hollow in Miss Wren's loop was a freak somehow."
"A peculiar hollow," said Millard. "That's amusing,
but no. Here was no accident. I'm certain these enhanced hollows were an integral part of the assault on our loops."
"But how?" said Emma. "What's changed about hollows that they can get into loops now?"
"That's something I've been thinking about a great deal," said Millard. "We don't know a lot about hollows, having never had the chance to examine one in a controlled setting. But it's thought that, like normals, they lack something which you and I and everyone in this train car possesses, some essential peculiarness, which is what allows us to interact with loops, to bind with and be absorbed into them."
"Like a key," I said.
"Something like that," said Millard.
"Some believe that, like blood or spinal fluid, our peculiarness has physical substance. Others think it's inside us, but insubstantial. A second soul."
"Huh," I said. I liked this idea, that peculiarness wasn't a deficiency, but an abundance, that it wasn't we who lacked something normals had, but they who lacked peculiarness, that we were more, not less.
"I hate all that crackpot stuff," said Emma. "The idea that you could capture the second soul in a jar gives me the quivers."
"And yet, over the years, some attempts have been made to do just this," said Millard.
"What did that white soldier say to you, Emma? I wish I could bottle what you have, or something to that effect."
Emma shuddered.
"Don't remind me."
"The theory goes that if somehow our peculiar essence could be distilled and captured, in a bottle, as he said, or more likely a petri dish, then perhaps that essence could also be transferred from one being to another. If this were possible, imagine the black market in peculiar souls that might spring up among the wealthy and unscrupulous. Peculiarities like your spark or Bronwyn's great strength sold to the highest bidder."
"That's disgusting," I said.
"Most peculiars agree with you," said Millard, "which is why such research was outlawed many years ago."
"As if the whites cared about our laws,"
said Emma. But the whole idea seems crazy, I said. It couldn't really work, could it?
I don't think so, said Millard. At least, not until yesterday. Now, I'm not so sure.
Because of the hollow in the menagerie loop?
Right. Before yesterday, I wasn't even certain I believed in a second soul. To my mind, there was only one compelling argument for its existence, that when a hologast consumes enough of us, it transforms into a different sort of creature, one that can travel through time loops.
It becomes a white, I said.
Yes, he said, but only if it consumes peculiars. It can eat as many normals as it likes, and it will never turn into a white. Therefore, we must have something normals lack.
But that hollow at the menagerie didn't become a white, said Emma. It became a hollow that could enter loops.
Which makes me wonder if the whites have been tinkering with nature, said Millard, vis-a-vis the transference of peculiar souls.
I don't even want to think about it, said Emma. Can we please, please talk about something else?
But where would they even get the souls, I asked, and how?
That's it, I'm sitting somewhere else, Emma said, and she got up to find another seat. Millard and I rode in silence for a while. I couldn't stop imagining being strapped to a table while a cabal of evil doctors removed my soul.
How would they do it?
With a needle?
A knife?
To derail this morbid train of thought, I tried changing the subject again. How did we all get to be peculiar in the first place? I asked.
No one's certain, Millard answered. There are legends, though.
Like what?
Some people believe we're descended from a handful of peculiars who lived a long, long time ago, he said. They were very powerful and enormous, like the stone giant we found.
I said, why are we so small then, if we used to be giants?
The story goes that over the years, as we multiplied, our power diluted. As we became less powerful, we got smaller too.
That's all pretty hard to swallow, I said. I feel about as powerful as an ant.
Ants are quite powerful, actually, relative to their size.
You know what I mean, I said. The thing I really don't get is, why me? I never asked to be this way. Who decided?
It was a rhetorical question. I wasn't really expecting an answer, but Millard gave me one anyway.
To quote a famous peculiar, at the heart of nature's mystery lies another mystery.
Who said that?
We know him as Perplexus Anomalous, an invented name probably for a great thinker and philosopher. Perplexus was a cartographer too. He drew the very first edition of the Map of Days 1,000-something years ago.
I chuckled. You talk like a teacher sometimes. Has anyone ever told you that?
All the time, Millard said. I would have liked to try my hand at teaching, if I hadn't been born like this.
You would have been great at it.
Thank you, he said. Then he went quiet, and in the silence I could feel him dreaming it, scenes from a life that might have been. After a while he said, I don't want you to think that I don't like being invisible. I do. I love being peculiar, Jacob. It's the very core of who I am. But there are days I wish I could turn it off.
I know what you mean, I said. But of course I didn't. My peculiarity had its challenges, but at least I could participate in society.
The door to our compartment slid open. Millard quickly flipped up the hood of his jacket to hide his face, or rather, his apparent lack of one. A young woman stood in the door. She wore a uniform and held a box of goods for sale.
Cigarettes? She asked. Chocolate?
No, thanks, I said. She looked at me.
You're an American?
Afraid so.
She gave me a pitying smile. Hope you're having a nice trip. You picked an awkward time to visit Britain. I laughed. So I've been told. She went out. Millard shifted his body to watch her go. Pretty, he said distantly. It occurred to me that it had probably been a lot of years since he'd seen a girl outside of those few who lived on Cairnholm. But what chance would someone like him have with a normal girl anyway? Don't look at me like that, he said. It hadn't occurred to me that I'd been looking at him any particular way. Like what? Like you feel bad for me. I don't, I said. But I did. Then Millard stood up from his seat, took off his coat, and disappeared. I didn't see him again for a while. The hours rolled on, and the children passed them by telling stories. They told stories about famous peculiars and about Miss Peregrine and the strange, exciting early days of her loop, and eventually they came around to telling their own stories. Some I had heard before, like how Enoch had raised the dead in his father's funeral parlor, or the way Bronwyn, at the tender age of 10, had snapped her abusive stepfather's neck without quite meaning to. But others were new to me. For as old as they were, the kids didn't often lapse into bouts of nostalgia. Horace's dreams had started when he was just 6, but he didn't realize they were predictive of anything until 2 years later, when one night he dreamed about the sinking of the Lusitania, and the next day heard about it on the radio. Hugh, from a young age, had loved honey more than any other food, and at 5 he'd started eating honeycomb along with it, so ravenously that the first time he accidentally swallowed a bee, he didn't notice until he felt it buzzing around in his stomach. The bee didn't seem to mind a bit, Hugh said, so I shrugged and went on eating. Pretty soon I had a whole hive down there. When the bees needed to pollinate, he'd gone to find a field of blooming flowers, and that's where he met Fiona, who was sleeping among them. Hugh told her story, too. Fiona was a refugee from Ireland, he said, where she'd been growing food for the people in her village during the famine of the 1840s, until she was accused of being a witch and chased out. This is something Hugh had gleaned only after years of subtle, nonverbal communication with Fiona, who didn't speak, not because she couldn't, Hugh said, but because the things she'd witnessed in the famine were so horrific, they stole her voice away. Then it was Emma's turn, but she had no interest in telling her story.
"Why not?" whined Olive. "Come on, tell about when you found out you were peculiar."
"It's ancient history," Emma muttered, "relevant to nothing. And hadn't we better be thinking about the future instead of the past?"
"Someone's being a grumpy puss," said Olive.
Emma got up and left, heading to the back of the car where no one would bother her. I let a minute or two pass so that she wouldn't feel hounded, then went and sat next to her. She saw me coming and hid behind a newspaper, pretending to read.
"Because I don't care to discuss it," she said from behind the paper. "That's why."
I didn't say anything.
"Yes, but you were going to ask, so I saved you the trouble."
"Just to make it fair," I said, "I'll tell you something about me first." She peeked over the top of the paper, slightly intrigued. "But don't I know everything about you already?"
"Ha," I said, "not hardly."
"All right. Then tell me 3 things about you I don't know. Dark secrets only, please. Quickly now." I racked my brain for interesting factoids about myself, but I could only think of embarrassing ones. "Okay, 1. When I was little, I was really sensitive to seeing violence on TV. I didn't understand that it wasn't real. Even if it was just a cartoon mouse punching a cartoon cat, I would freak out and start crying." Her newspaper came down some.
"Bless your tender soul," she said. "And now look at you, impaling monstrous creatures right through their leaky eyeballs."
2, I said. "I was born on Halloween,
and until I was 8 years old, my parents had me convinced that the candy people gave out when I knocked on their doors was birthday presents.
Hmm, she said, lowering the paper a little more. That one was only middlingly dark. You may continue, nevertheless.
3. When we first met, I was convinced you were about to cut my throat. But scared as I was, there was this tiny voice in my head saying, "If this is the last face you ever see, at least it's a beautiful one." The paper fell to her lap.
"Jacob, that's..."
She looked at the floor, then out the window, then back at me.
"What a sweet thing to say."
"It's true," I said, and slid my hand across the seat to hers. "Okay, your turn."
"I'm not trying to hide anything, you know. It's just that those musty stories make me feel 10 years old again. And unwanted. That never goes away. No matter how many magical summer days have come between."
That hurt was still with her, raw, even all these years later.
"I want to know you," I said. "Who you are, where you come from. That's all."
She shifted uncomfortably.
"I never told you about my parents.
All I know, I heard from Golan that night in the ice house. He said they gave you away to a traveling circus."
"No, not quite."
She slid down in her seat, her voice falling to a whisper.
"I suppose it's better for you to know the truth than rumors and speculation. So here goes. I started manifesting when I was just 10. Kept setting my bed on fire in my sleep, till my parents took away all my sheets and made me lie on a bare metal cot in a bare room, with nothing flammable at all in it. They thought I was a pyromaniac and a liar, and the fact that I myself never seemed to get burned was as good as proof. But I couldn't be burned, something even I didn't know at first. I was 10, I didn't know a fig about anything. It's a very scary thing, manifesting without understanding what's happening to you, though it's a fright nearly all peculiar children experience because so few of us are born to peculiar parents."
"I can imagine," I said.
"One day, as far as anyone knew, I was as common as rice pudding, and the next I felt a curious itch in the palms of my hands. They grew red and swollen, then hot. So hot that I ran to the grocer's and buried them in a case of frozen cod. When the fish began to thaw and stink, the grocer chased me home again, where he demanded that my mother pay for all I'd ruined. My hands were burning up by this time. The ice had only made it worse. Finally, they caught fire, and I was sure I'd gone stark raving mad."
"What did your parents think?" I asked.
"My mother, who was a deeply superstitious person, ran out of the house and never came back. She thought I was a demon, arrived straight from hell via her womb. The old man took a different approach. He beat me and locked me in my room. And when I tried to burn through the door, he tied me down with asbestos sheets. Kept me like that for days, feeding me once in a while by hand, since he didn't trust me enough to untie me, which was a good thing for him, 'cause the minute he did, I would have burned him black."
"I wish you had," I said.
"That's sweet of you, but it wouldn't have done any good. My parents were horrible people, but if they hadn't been, and if I had stayed with them much longer, there's no question the Hollows would have found me. I owe my life to two people. My younger sister, Julia, who freed me late one night so that I could finally run away. And Miss Peregrine, who discovered me a month later, working as a fire eater at a traveling circus."
Emma smiled wistfully.
"The day I met her, that's what I call my birthday. The day I met my true mum."
My heart melted a little.
Thank you for telling me, I said.
Hearing Emma's story made me feel closer to her, and less alone in my own confusion. Every peculiar had struggled through a period of painful uncertainty. Every peculiar had been tried. The glaring difference between us was that my parents still loved me, and despite the problems I'd had with them, I loved them too, in my own quiet way. The thought that I was hurting them now was a constant ache. What did I owe them? How could it be reckoned against the debt I owed Miss Peregrine, or my obligation to my grandfather, or the sweet, heavy thing I felt for Emma, which seemed to grow stronger every time I looked at her? The scales tipped always toward the latter. But eventually, if I lived through this, I would have to face up to the decision I had made, and the pain I had caused. If always propelled my thoughts back to the present, because if depended so much on keeping my wits about me. I couldn't properly sense things if I was distracted. If demanded my full presence and participation in now. If, as much as it scared me, also kept me sane. London approached. Villages giving way to towns, giving way to unbroken tracts of suburbia. I wondered what was waiting for us there. What new horrors lay ahead. I glanced at a headline in the newspaper still open in Emma's lap. Air raids rattle capital. Scores dead. I closed my eyes and tried to think of nothing at all. Part 2. If anyone had been watching as the 8:30 train hissed into the station and ground to a steaming halt, they wouldn't have noticed anything out of the ordinary about it. Not about the conductors and porters who wrestled open its latches and threw back its doors. Not about the mass of men and women, some in military dress, who streamed out and disappeared into the swarming crowd. Not even about the 8 weary children who filed heavily from one of its first-class cars and stood blinking in the hazy light of the platform, their backs pressed together in a protective circle, dazed by the cathedral of noise and smoke in which they found themselves. On an ordinary day, any group of children as lost and forlorn-looking as these would have been approached by some kindly adult and asked what the matter was, or whether they needed help, or where their parents were. But today, the platform teemed with hundreds of children, all of whom looked lost and forlorn. So no one paid much attention to the little girl with tumbling brown hair and button shoes, or the fact that her shoes did not quite touch the floor. No one noticed the moon-faced boy in the flat cap, or the honeybee that drifted from his mouth, tested the sooty air, then dove back from whence it came. No one's gaze lingered on the boy with dark-ringed eyes, or saw the clay man who peeked from his shirt pocket only to be pushed down again by the boy's finger. Likewise, the boy who was dressed to the nines in a muddy but finely tailored suit and stove-in top hat, his face drawn and haggard from lack of sleep, for he hadn't allowed himself any in days, so afraid was he of his dreams. No one more than glanced at the big girl in the coat and simple dress, who was built like a stack of bricks and had lashed to her back a steamer trunk nearly as large as herself. No one who saw her could have guessed how stupendously heavy the trunk was, or what it held, or why a screen of tiny holes had been punched into one side. Overlooked completely was the young man next to her, so wrapped in scarves and a hooded coat that not an inch of his bare skin could be seen, though it was early September and the weather still warm. Then there was the American boy, so ordinary-looking he hardly merited notice, so apparently normal that people's eyes skipped over him, even as he studied them
on tiptoe, neck swiveling, his gaze sweeping across the platform like a sentry's. The girl by his side stood with her hands clasped together, concealing a tendril of flame that curled stubbornly around the nail of her pinky, which happened sometimes when she was upset. She tried shaking her finger as one might to extinguish a match, then blowing on it. When that didn't work, she slipped it into her mouth and let a puff of smoke coil from her nose. No one saw that, either. In fact, no one looked closely enough at the children from the first-class car of the 8:30 train to notice anything peculiar about them at all. Which was just as well. Chapter 8 Emma nudged me.
So? I need another minute, I said.
Bronwyn had set down her trunk, and I was standing on it now, head above the crowd, casting my eyes over a shifting sea of faces. The long platform teemed with children. They squirmed like amoebas under a microscope, row upon row receding into a haze of smoke. Hissing black trains loomed up on either side, anxious to swallow them. I could feel my friend's eyes on my back, watching me as I scanned the crowd. I was supposed to know whether, somewhere in that great seething mass, there were monsters who meant to kill us. And I was supposed to know it simply by looking, by assessing some vague feeling in my gut. Usually it was painful and obvious when a hollow was nearby, but in a giant space like this, among hundreds of people, my warning might only be a whisper, the faintest twinge, easy to miss.
"Do the whites know we're coming?"
Bronwyn asked, talking low for fear she'd be overheard by a normal, or worse yet, a white. They had ears everywhere in the city, or so we'd been led to believe.
"We killed every one of them that might have known where we were going," Hugh said proudly. "Or rather, I did."
"Which means they'll be looking for us even harder," Millard said. "And they'll want more than the bird now. They'll want revenge."
"Which is why we can't stand here much longer," Emma said, tapping me on the leg. "Are you almost finished?"
My focus slipped. I lost my place in the crowd, began again.
"One more minute," I said.
Personally, it wasn't whites that concerned me most, but hollows. I'd killed two of them now, and each encounter had nearly been the end of me. My luck, if that's what had been keeping me alive thus far, had to be running out. That's why I was determined never to be surprised by another hollow. I would do everything in my power to sense them from a distance and avoid contact altogether. There was less glory in running away from a fight, sure, but I didn't care about glory. I just wanted to survive. The real danger, then, wasn't the figures on the platform, but the shadows that lay between and beyond them, the darkness at the margins. That's where I focused my attention. It gave me an out-of-body sort of feeling to cast my sense out into a crowd this way, prodding distant corners for traces of danger. It wasn't something I could have done a few days ago. My ability to direct it like a spotlight, this was new. What else, I wondered, was left to discover about myself? "We're okay," I said, stepping down from the trunk. "No hollows."
"I could have told you that," grumbled Enoch. "If there had been, they'd have eaten us by now."
Emma took me aside.
"If we're going to have a fighting chance here, you've got to be faster."
It was like asking someone who'd just learned to swim to compete in the Olympics.
"I'm doing my best," I said.
Emma nodded.
"I know you are."
She turned to the others and snapped her fingers for attention.
"Let's head for that phone box," she said, pointing to a tall red phone booth across the platform, just visible through the surging crowd.
"Who are we calling?" Hugh asked.
"The peculiar dog said that all of London's loops had been raided and their Imbrins kidnapped," Emma said.
but we can't simply take his word for it, can we?
You can call a time loop? I said, flabbergasted.
On the phone?
Millard explained that the Council of Imbrins maintained a phone exchange, though it could be used only within the boundaries of the city.
Quite ingenious how it works, given all the time differences, he said. Just because we live in time loops doesn't mean we're stuck in the Stone Age.
Emma took my hand and told the others to join hands too.
It's crucial we stay together, she said. London is vast, and there's no lost and found here for peculiar children.
We waded into the crowd, hands linked, our snaking line slightly parabolic in the middle where Olive buoyed up like an astronaut walking on the moon.
You losing weight? Bronwyn asked her. You need heavier shoes, little magpie.
I get feathery when I ain't had proper meals, Olive said.
Proper meals? We just ate like kings.
Not me, said Olive. They didn't have any meat pies.
You're awfully picky for a refugee, said Enoch. Anyway, since Horus wasted all our money, the only way we're getting more food is if we steal it, or find a not-kidnapped Imbrin who'll cook us some.
We still have money,
Horus said defensively, jingling the coins in his pocket.
Though not enough for meat pies. We could perhaps afford a jacket potato.
If I have another jacket potato, I'll turn into a jacket potato,
Olive whined.
That's impossible, dear, said Bronwyn.
Why? Miss Peregrine can turn into a bird.
A boy we were passing turned to stare. Bronwyn shushed Olive angrily. Telling our secrets in front of normals was strictly forbidden. Even if they were so fantastic-sounding, no one would believe them. We shouldered through one last knot of children to arrive at the phone booth. It was only large enough to hold three, so Emma, Millard, and Horace squeezed inside while the rest of us crowded around the door. Emma worked the phone, Horace fished our last few coins from his pocket, and Millard paged through a chunky phone book that dangled from a cord.
"Are you kidding?" I said, leaning into the booth. "There are Imbrins in the phone book?"
"The addresses listed are fakes," said Millard, "and the calls won't connect unless you whistle the right passcode."
He tore out a listing and handed it to Emma.
"Give this one a go. Millicent Thrush."
Horace fed a coin into the slot, and Emma dialed the number. Then Millard took the phone, whistled a bird call into the receiver, and handed it back to Emma. She listened for a moment, then frowned.
"It just rings," she said. "No one's picking up." "No bother," Millard said. "That was just one of many. Let me find another."
Outside the booth, the crowd that had been flowing around us slowed to a stop, bottlenecking somewhere out of sight. The train platform was reaching capacity. There were normal children on every side of us, chattering to one another, shouting, shoving, and one, who stood right next to Olive, was crying bitterly. She had pigtails and puffy red eyes, and she carried a blanket in one hand and a raggedy cardboard suitcase in the other. Pinned to her blouse was a tag with words and numbers stenciled in large print, 115-201, London to Sheffield. Olive watched the girl cry until her own eyes began to shimmer with tears. Finally, she couldn't take it anymore and asked what the matter was. The girl looked away, pretending not to have heard. Olive didn't take the hint.
"What's the matter?" she asked again. "Are you crying because you've been sold?"
She pointed to the tag on the girl's blouse.
"What was your price?"
The girl tried to scoot away, but was blocked by a wall of people.
"I would buy you and set you free," Olive went on, "but I fear we've spent all our money on train tickets and haven't enough even for meat pies, much less a slave. I'm awfully sorry."
The girl spun to face Olive.
"I'm not for sale,"
she said, stamping her foot. Are you certain?
Yes!
The girl shouted, and in a fit of frustration she ripped the tag off her blouse and threw it away.
I just don't